Welcome to Entrepreneurs the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer, and I've been blessed to do this for about 2,500 episodes, and I have a repeat offender, so I must be doing something right to have someone like Patrick McEnroe allow me to interview him again. He is one of my favorite people. He's the executive director at the John McEnroe Tennis Academy, but he's also the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. And of course, one of my favorite broadcasters, tennis analysts at ESPN and Sirius XM, our family welcomes Patrick McEnroe back to the playbook. Thank you, my friend, for being
here. I was feeling a little left out, David. It took you so long to get me back, but it's awesome to be back with you. I've been following your stuff. You're killing it. So congrats on that. Happy birthday. I know you just had your birthday, so happy birthday there. And let's hope everyone has a happy and healthy 2026. It's not too late to say that, right? We can still say that.
You can absolutely still say that, as long as we're still in January. Now, yeah. I want to start with your podcast, because I love your podcast as well, Holding Court, which I've been blessed to be a guest on as well. It is really an opportunity not just to stay on top of the emotional aspects of what's going on in the world and tennis, in the world of tennis, but it also, to me, elevates my awareness to kind of world thoughts in, you know, this ununified, conflictual world we're living in. When we're holding court, we're trying to appreciate our differences. What are some of the commonalities that you're learning beyond business development of having a podcast, the lessons that you learn while you're interviewing these people? Are we on a hopeful journey, or are we moving in the wrong direction? And as sports is a microcosm to what's going on in the world.
Well, we have to be hopeful, David. That's something I've learned over the years, is that's really what we have to do. And so doing my podcast, doing the radio show, to me, they're pretty much one and the same, right? And I do want also for the International Tennis Hall of Fame, it's called Tennis Worthy. And on that one, I kind of can dig into, you know, the Jim Lehrers of the world. And, you know, he's a guy that's been at the forefront of mental health, right? Way before we were even talking about it, like that athletes were talking about it, awareness of just our own journeys, right? And how they connect with whether you're a Hall of Fame tennis player, of which there are very few, or you participate in a sport at a local level. You know, to be the executive director at the John McEnroe Tennis Academy, which is where I spend most of my time with kids, you know, from the ages of 5 to 17 before they go off to college. That to me is very rewarding, you know, because not only can you learn from people I talk to on the podcast, on the radio show, but I think you can learn a lot from kids. And I always tell my coaches at our academy, you know, young guys and gals that play tennis in college, and many of them have varying backgrounds, which is one of the beautiful things about tennis. It's a very international game. And so you meet people from everywhere. And I say, you know, when they see a kid who's upset, you know, even a little kid who's maybe crying about their day at school or they missed a shot. And a lot of times the coach's first reaction is, you know, don't cry. Why are you crying? And I learned in my years, even in parenting workshops, that the most important thing to do is to listen. You know, listen to the kids, ask them questions, acknowledge their, hey, you're upset. You know, I see you're crying. And you'll be amazed that once you do that with, especially with little kids, that their eyes sort of change because they realize that you hear them. And I think doing that with kids has opened my eyes more so when I do my show or whatever I do, to make sure you're listening and acknowledging people and what they think. And I think in the world we live in now, David, we could all use some more of that.
I love it. And, you know, one of the areas that I'm working in the entrepreneur side with children as well, as the Chief Chancellor of Junior Achievement University, so I have entrepreneurs from 5 into 25, is the change in their perspective because of social media. The expectations seem to be so much higher that they want what other people want, or they want what social media makes them want. And it creates this chasm between, this is who I am today, and this is what I want people to think I am. And this energy gap really puts a lot of pressure in every area. And I imagine it's exponential in tennis, where, you know, you're dealing with kids that are so young that are watching the best in the world. And yet people expectations, you only can do what you can do when you're 10. What are some of the things that we can do to help people with this chasm, this energy gap between I am and this is what I want people to think I am?
You know, I think the day-to-day journey is so important, David. And, you know, tennis, you're right, it's a tough sport because it's so individual, right? And I learned this even myself when I first came on the tour after having played 4 years of college tennis at Stanford, which, you know, was a great achievement. It was an awesome place to be. Won 2 national championships as part of the team there. And then you go to the pros and it's a whole different level, right? And you realize, you know, fairly soon I realized that there's just certain players I was never going to beat. You know, there's certain guys that are just better than me. You know, Andre Agassi was just going to kick my butt every time I played him, no matter what I did. So you have to sort of acknowledge that within yourself. And then I think you have to set goals for yourself, you know, small goals, whether it's, hey, you know, can I do one more rep on the chest press? Or, you know, can I get my speed just a little bit better in the speed drill I'm doing? And so those little like markers, I think, can help you as a tennis player because, you know, the wins and loss, you know, I tell parents all the time, if your kid or, you know, wants to get into really high level competitive tennis, you better get used to losing because, you know, I'm going to the Australian Open shortly to cover that tournament for ESPN, as I've done for many years. And, you know, these are the best players in the world. And only one of them is going to walk away from the tournament having not lost a match, only one man and one woman. And so you have to be able to deal with that and then find things along the way that can say, hey, you know what? I mean, it's all about, Dave, it's a cliche, but it's true. Be the best that I can be. And I think for kids nowadays, you know, I've got 3 teenage daughters, so I see them, you know, studying till late and getting up early and, you know, wanting to do extra work. And 2 of them are dancers and 1 was, you know, pretty competitive junior tennis player. And balancing all that is tricky. And to me, like, I've never said to my kids, like, don't go on social media, right? Because it's a part of their life. But they got to be able to manage it. And I think you have to trust them to make the right decisions, which is not always easy for teenagers in the world we live in.
Yeah. You still as a parent need to empower, but still be cautious knowing the age. I'm a parent of 4, 3 daughters as well with 1 baby oops at 15. So still dealing right. with social media and the impact that it has. One of the things that you mentioned is really interesting. I represented the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So marketed with Warren Moon, Troy Aikman, Steve Young. And it was interesting because I was a below average college football player who got rejected, by the way, twice from my dream school, a school called Stanford. I actually asked John Hennessy if he would give me an honorary doctorate for Stanford. He told me I couldn't handle the coursework even. Actually right. probably been rejected 3 times now by Stanford.
Right.
It was interesting you mentioned because, you know, you're a McEnroe and there's expectations of being a McEnroe. But everybody has their skills and knowledge as a basement. And then you have desire to create this delta. And it's applicable in every subject matter, topic, and expertise in life. And it was interesting playing college football because I have a really low basement, you know, comparatively, no matter how hard I try. Ryan Leaf, who's one of the biggest busts in football and our client, you know, we used to joke around. I'm like, no matter how much I have a desire that I must be what I can be, my delta from my basement will never even be your basement, Ryan. You're so talented. Right. Yeah. And even within the context of the Hall of Fame, I really found it remarkable that there was still layers of basements in the Hall of Fame. You know, there was the upper echelons of the Hall of Famers.
Right.
And then there's John Randalls and, you know, other guys that looked up to the Troy Aikmans and the Steve Youngs of the world. But it's true fulfillment that comes from the delta. And one of the things that we try really hard, and I know you do as well, is to inspire kids to create a pursuit of their own potential and let go of this outcome attachment. Have you learned any mechanisms or techniques to help people decipher between pursuing their own potential and detaching? Some people call it surrendering, but that gets really confusing to kids.
Right.
But detaching emotionally from the outcome, just doing their best, learning lessons, and having fun.
Yeah, that's a huge challenge, David. And I think again, the key for me with these kids is to acknowledge their disappointment, right? Or what I call the reality check when that happens, because you kind of have to go through it as a person. You know, I remember. When I was at Stanford, my last year, I studied for the law boards because I was thinking, you know, maybe I'm not good enough to make it in pro tennis. And my brother was number one in the world. My mom was always very concerned that I, you know, had to live in John's shadow, right, as a player. So she was sort of pushing me, like, you know, maybe you shouldn't try pro tennis, you know. And I studied my butt off, David. And by the way, the only reason I got into Stanford was because I was the number one recruit in the country the year I was a junior tennis player. I tell my daughters that all the time. They're like studying their butts off. They're trying to improve their SAT scores, which are already great. And I'm like, listen, I got into Stanford because I was a great junior tennis player. And then I managed it well, you know. But anyway, I'm studying for the law boards. I'm doing pretty well in the practice tests. I take the test the day after I graduated from Stanford, which was probably a mistake. But I never did really that well on those kind of tests. And I got my scores back and I looked at my scores and I showed them to my mom. And she said, son, I think professional tennis is in your future, you know. So it was sort of a funny. I tell that in a lot of the speeches I give, that story. But you know, my brother was a great supporter of me because he kind of stepped in and said, "Listen, Mom, you know, let Patrick's good. Like he can make it." I was already, you know, pretty successful in doubles. So I think you have to just understand what the kid is going through. And again, acknowledge that, you know, we have a lot of kids, David, when they're 9, 10 years old and their parents is particularly, you know, everybody thinks at that age you could be a pro. You know what I'm saying? And by the time you get to around 13, 14, you kind of become aware of where you're at, you know, and so that's to me like a key time for the kid and for the family around them that they can, you know, they play for the right reasons, you know, whether it's trying to play in D1 college, maybe D3 in college, maybe play just on their high school team, you know, whatever it is. And I think that acknowledgement and understanding goes a long way. I don't have the magic elixir. You know, you asked me the question, I'm going around and around because there's really no easy answer. And, sure. And sometimes you lose some kids because maybe the expectations were too high. But if they love the game, if they like competing and they like improving themselves, then I think it's a worthwhile journey for that person, that individual, no matter what the level you can get to is.
Speaking of the levels that we can get to, watching professional tennis now with the Australian Open starting here this weekend, and you'll be down there again, covering it and helping us to understand the game better and the personalities. And that's really, I think, what attaches so many people to tennis is that while you're watching tennis, the analysts like you bring out the B-roll in the players and with the knowledge of what it's really like to be there. Watching tennis for all these years and playing yourself, I love to know the differential of leveling up. And with all the technology and the medicine and the mindset coaches and performance things that are available, you know, where do you see the differentiate? I don't like to compare generational athletes. They always ask me to do that. But I just like to understand, you know, these players today, are they at a whole nother level? Like the, you know, number 100th player, is that like the number 20th player when you were playing or your brother was playing? Like where is that differential today with all of the different advantages the younger players have?
Well, I would say definitely like I would call myself sort of a journeyman type player, you know, ranked between 30 and 100 for most of my career. And I would think the level's gone up exponentially. There's no doubt there's more really good players now than there ever been. But the guys at the top it's mostly genetic, to be honest. I mean, 99% of the reason Sinner and Alcaraz dominate is because their genetics, and their genetics are
like Serena and Venus.
They're unbelievably fast. They're quick twitch muscles. They also have the endurance, you know, which you train for. So these players train, you know, now the reason you're seeing Novak Djokovic still playing at a high level at 39 is because the recovery is better. They understand how to take care of their body. They understand how to stay more limber. I just had surgery, David, 3 months ago. I had a little tear in my rotator cuff. And I'm doing all these movements and exercises with the guy, just rehabbing. And I'm saying to myself, man, I wish I had you 40 years ago when I was 19. You know, because, you know, just the ways to get it better are much better. But I will say this, because I was having this conversation with someone the other day. And I said, if my brother or Bjorn Borg grew up today, they would still be number one in the world. They would still be the best. Now, if you go back and watch their match and you compare to the, you know, match you watched with Sinner and Alcaraz, it looks like it's in slow motion, right?
Right.
But if you gave them the same technology and the same training, you know, Borg was one of the greatest athletes ever in any sport. So he, you know, if you gave him a Babolat racket, the racket Rafael Nadal used on clay, you know, he could have won 10, if he played longer, you know, 10, 12 French Opens too. He ended up only winning 6 because he retired at 25, you know. And so the answer is yes, the game has evolved because of the technology. The speed of the game has increased exponentially. So that means the speed of movement. You can't take as big of a swing on the ball. You know, all those things that players adjust to. But the reality is the best from eras past would still be the best today if they grew up with the same equipment.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. Now, last question. You're coming back to the Australian Open. I've been blessed to be around the Masters for 35 years, the Super Bowl for 35 years. And when I'm on my way to these events, I kind of diminish, because it's been so many years, how exciting and special it really is. But the minute I get there, it's like going to Disneyland for the first time again. Number one, do you have that same feeling once you get to the Australian Open? And two, what excites you the most about this Open?
Well, actually, the Australian Open is actually my favorite tournament to go to now, because I get to leave winter in New York. Which my wife is always not crazy about. She's like, oh, I hate that end of January when you go to Australia. But I get to go to, you know, the middle of summer down there. So it's a long trip. It's a long trip home. But what I love about the event is kind of like the U.S. Open, but there's even more space. It feels more relaxed there. The fans are huge sports fans. The entire country, David, gets behind the event because it's really their biggest international sporting event that they have, where people are coming from all over the world. Yes, they have Australian rules football. They have other sports that are big within Australia. But this is sort of the biggest sport they have internationally. And the whole country, therefore, kind of gets behind it. And, you know, you can walk from downtown Melbourne to the site, you know, which you can't do at any of the other majors. And it's the beginning of the year. Everybody's in a good mood. All the, you know, most of the players are coming from Europe as well. So they're leaving their winter. And Roger Federer called it the happy slam. Everybody's happy. The people are friendly. They roll out the red carpet for the players, for the media and so on. There's great restaurants, great things to do. So if I were telling someone that could only go to one tennis event, excuse me, David, I would probably tell them to go to Wimbledon, because it's so unique. Because you mentioned the Masters, you know, Wimbledon is sort of our Masters, the tradition, the grass courts, you know, it's a private club, all those things. But if someone that's kind of been around tennis, and I always say that my most fun event now attending and working at is the Australian Open. There's outdoor activities for families. There's 20-year-olds going there to go to the bars and, you know, party where they get the tennis in the background. And then there's hardcore sports fans and tennis fans as well. So it's pretty much got it all.
Well, you got to start bringing your wife down there, just from a man who's been married for 28 years and travels with his wife. It makes a big difference when I get home. It's much more expensive. Of course, especially when they're not hanging out with you as you're covering it and they're shopping around the world.
Right.
Well worth it, my friend. Anyway, come and join us both on SiriusXM, an incredible person with an incredible insight. Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe at Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe, or at patrick.mcenroe, I believe, anywhere you can find him. He's great insights and just a good person. As you know, my philosophy is being kind to your future self and doing good deeds. At the level Patrick McEnroe is at, he continues to be kind and continues to do good deeds. We appreciate you so much. And please promise me it won't be another 1,000 episodes before I see you. Incredible guest. Thank you so much, everyone. Patrick McEnroe, president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, broadcaster, my favorite analyst on SiriusXM and podcaster. And of course, running is John McEnroe Tennis Academy. Thanks for joining me on The Playbook.